Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
The community doesn't want to attend the celebratory occasion, given that we want to send our prayers and our thoughts to the families who are suffering in Gaza and around the world.
It's Ramadan. As the holiest month of the year begins for Muslims around the world, there's still no end in sight for Israel's siege of Gaza. It's Monday, March 11th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, on the start of Ramadan. And 4 years ago today, things got real. March 11th, 2020 was when the WHO officially declared COVID-19 a pandemic. It was also when the NBA canceled the season and we found out Tom Hanks had COVID. That all does feel like a long time ago, which is why the creators of the Pandemic Journaling Project wanted to preserve the memories and feelings of people coping with the lockdown years. The grief, but also moments of joy.
She was really moved by people's desire to help each other, by people's feeling of collective hardship and feeling like they were all in this together. It didn't last long, unfortunately, in our country, but it did exist, and that was something I think that was special.
That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But we'll start the show in Haiti, where the U.S. government overnight airlifted non-essential staff from its embassy in Port-au-Prince. For days now, the country has been in upheaval. Armed gangs have attacked police stations, freed thousands of people from prison, and have threatened to overthrow the government. The acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, is stranded in Puerto Rico, unable to return to the country. Harold Isaac is an independent journalist based outside Port-au-Prince. He spoke to Peter O'Dowd.
Harold, please start by telling us more about the evacuation of the American embassy. When and how did it happen?
Well, as you stated, it was a nighttime operation. Folks around the early hours of Sunday were hearing helicopters going by near the embassy. And by 5 a.m, the embassy issued a note on X to say that they were proceeding to evacuations. It was basically extracting part of the staff, at least the American staff, away from the capital.
You're in Haiti near the epicenter of this crisis. When you step outside, can you tell that the gangs are in control? What do you see?
Well, I am personally in one of the remaining safe parts of the city, but the question is for how long. Essentially, the gangs are controlling about 80% of the capital, and the struggle you've been hearing about is for their fight to take over the remaining 20. And it has been a difficult time in the city, at least for the past week, as it stands right now.
And what's that fighting look like for the remainder of the city?
Well, it's a checkered reality. Many folks have to be, you know, on the lookout and try and sort out how they run their errands, how they go out, resupply, and come back home. What's going on right now is that port facilities were attacked, and right now Haiti is in Port-au-Prince, at least, is cut off from the rest of the world because the international airport is shut down.
Well, exactly, which is one of the reasons why the prime minister is stuck in Puerto Rico. He was coming back from a trip to Kenya where he was trying to secure some UN-backed police help. What have we heard from him? What's he saying about the situation?
Well, precisely. We haven't heard pretty much anything from him. He's been silent ever since he's been stranded in Puerto Rico. There is this very important meeting in Jamaica today, and it's unclear whether it'll be seen there. That That being said, it's been very complicated for him to return home, and we don't know whether he will anytime soon.
Yeah, that meeting you reference is with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other Caribbean leaders in Jamaica. I'm sure many people are wondering, though, if the prime minister cannot get into the country or even really anywhere close to it, what does that mean for the government?
That's anybody's guess at this point. There is this void in effect right now. Although the remaining part of that government has declared a state of emergency with a nighttime curfew, it is unclear what the path forward is. And that meeting in Jamaica is coming as a response from the CARICOM and the international community to the crisis that has aggravated here in Haiti.
So what will you be watching for on that front from the meeting in Jamaica?
Well, everybody, I think, is paying attention. I believe even the gangs. We've had a relatively calm 24 hours in the city, but everybody obviously is expecting something to come out of it. What it's going to be and its effectiveness remains to be seen.
Have the gangs described what they ultimately want?
Well, the first thing they did as a reaction to Henri's travel to official trip to Kenya to ink an agreement with the Kenyan officials about the deployment of police officers was to unite and wage severe violence in order to topple the government. Now that they have, for the most part, virtually done that, now they want to be part essentially of the discussion or lead the choice of the next rulers of Haiti.
Well, people must be absolutely terrified when you get out on the streets and you talk to everyday Haitians who have already gone through so much for so many years. What are you hearing from them about how their lives are, but also where they want the future of the country to go?
I think for average Joes and average folks here, they're stunned by the situation, how we reached a new low. I mean, for a long time, the airport always appeared to be off limits. And with that being, with the attacks waged against the airports and ports facilities, it feels like we've been officially cut off from the world. And they're still reeling and trying to understand what that actually means for their daily lives. And it's unclear.
Journalist Harold Isaac is in Haiti covering the gang violence that is threatening the future of the Haitian government and the lives of the many people who live there. Harold, thank you very much for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, it's Ramadan. A holy month for some 2 billion Muslims around the world who observe the holiday with acts of charity and prayer, as well as fasting from sunrise to sunset. But with so many on the brink of famine in Gaza, this Ramadan feels different for many Muslims, including those here in America. After the break, we'll hear from the mayor of the city home to the largest per capita community of American Muslims about how he and his neighbors are observing Ramadan.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Muslims around the world began celebrating the holy month of Ramadan at sunrise. The holiday marks the occasion of the first lines of the Quran coming down from heaven to the Prophet Muhammad. Abdullah Hamoud is the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, which is home to the largest Muslim and Arab American communities in the U.S. per capita. Here's his conversation with Peter.
It is such an important time for Muslims around the world. So for those who don't observe Ramadan, what does the holiday, what does it mean to you and to others?
Well, for Muslims, this is the holiest month in the calendar year. And, you know, you abstain from drinking or eating from sunrise to sunset. And the essential purpose of it is while you're in your most vulnerable state, one of hunger and thirst, you try to be the most beautiful of people that you can possibly be. Somebody who is kinder, who is more thoughtful, who is seeking closeness to God, who is ready to help and assist and uplift their community, who is, you know, finding themselves taking in more into prayer and du'at, as we call it. And so it's a beautiful time of year.
In addition to the fasting, I understand it's also a time to spend with family and community, especially during iftar, which is the meal that breaks each day's fast. I'm just curious, what are your fondest memories of Ramadan?
I've been fasting for maybe upwards of 25 years now. And for me, you know, the fondest memories, when you first start as a child and you're not really able to make it through the whole day, it was, you know, the chocolates that my grandmother would give us by making it halfway through the day. She would sneak us a chocolate halfway through the day to try to get us, you know, to fast another 4 hours. And obviously, you know, it doesn't count that way. And then most recently, you know, as somebody, you know, as a father now, as somebody who has, you know, a father of two and now breaking bread around the table with my wife, with my children, with my extended family. It really is the most joyous time, and there's nothing more special than breaking bed with even neighbors who might not necessarily be Arab or Muslim, but who also partake in the celebration of Ramadan here in the city of Dearborn.
Joyous, but also this year very painful for people in your community. Of course, Israel's assault on Gaza, we now know, has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians, some of whom have relatives in Dearborn. How is this affecting Ramadan this year in your city? Does it feel different?
It certainly does. You know, there's a blanket of grief across the whole city of Dearborn, especially for those who have lost loved ones. You know, we had a resident that came to a council meeting several weeks ago who talked about losing 80 family members in Gaza. I certainly imagine in that household Ramadan is different. And for all of us, that's the pain that we all feel with that community member. Also, you know, we traditionally have been hosting the Ramadan Sahur Festival, which is a festival that actually happens on 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. on weekends. And so you obviously have the iftar, which is where you break your fast when the sun sets. But then you're able to eat essentially until the sun rises. And so we have a festival of sorts that occurs during those hours. And it draws over 150,000 people annually. And this year the festival has actually been suspended because of what's happening in Gaza and the understanding that the community doesn't want to attend a celebratory occasion, given that we want to send our prayers and our thoughts to the families who are suffering in Gaza and around the world. But you're starting to see that people are not in as celebratory as a mood and going to find themselves probably spending more time at home.
Can we talk about this idea of fasting? Because more than 2 billion Muslims around the world are going to choose to go without food and water for most of each day for an entire month. But in Gaza now, tens of thousands of people are forced to do that, essentially. There is no choice. Children are dying of hunger. The UN describes hunger levels as catastrophic there. With that in mind, how are you reflecting on your own fast this Ramadan?
You know, it's, I think as a father, it hits you a little harder to watch children suffering of starvation and famine when there's no need for anybody to suffer around the globe. You know, we have enough resources around this world to ensure that doesn't happen. I think I struggle, you know, going back and forth between grief and disappointment in the fact that, you know, our president has not been able to hold to account the Israeli government to permit humanitarian aid to come in and to ensure that nobody dies from starvation or famine, and that this is a war crime. It's a tactic used to oppress a people to an extent that we have never seen. And I think what's different this time around is that the genocide of the Palestinian people is being live streamed for the world to watch. And we all feel helpless here in the city of Dearborn, not knowing what we can do to help alleviate the suffering.
Does fasting help in any way?
Fasting, you know, I spend a lot more time at the mosque during this month, a lot more time with family, and, you know, really begin to reflect internally and trying to find that closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it certainly helps in that way. You know, I put all my faith in God. I firmly believe that. And while I might not understand what's unfolding or the reason or the rationale, I put my hope in God that the Palestinian people will one day find a just solution and a just Palestinian state.
Is that what you'll be praying for this Ramadan?
I pray for that before Ramadan started, and I'll be praying for it far after Ramadan is done. And I think that's a prayer that you'll possibly hear from millions upon millions of people from around the globe all praying for.
Abdallah Hamoud is the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, on this first day of the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, to some extent, I think we've all blocked out the pandemic years. A lot of people would rather forget that time spent under lockdown, being bombarded by horrific epidemiological statistics every day, and much worse, the news of friends or family falling ill and dying. Well, there's value in remembering how that felt, according to our next guests. When we return, Peter speaks with the founders of the Pandemic Journaling Project about their mission to preserve memories of that time and what we can learn from that grief 4 years later. That's after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
On this day, 4 years ago, the world was shutting down. I remember watching on TV as the remainder of the NBA basketball season was canceled and understanding that our lives were about to change. Of course, what followed was profoundly worse than a few lost basketball games. We watched in horror as the COVID-19 virus spread like fire across the world, as hospitals ran out of masks, as exhausted nurses and doctors and grocery store workers risked their lives to go to work. 4 years later, many of us are still struggling with the loss of a loved one. More than 1 million people in the United States dead, many of them dying alone in the ICU. The Pandemic Journaling Project captures some of the anxiety and grief we were feeling. 1,800 people around the world submitted more than 27,000 entries, creating a record of an uncertain time. Here are a few of the entries.
There are protesters where I live that protest the enforcement of wearing masks.
Institutions that our whole lives we were taught were there to look out for the people and were of the people and by the people and for the people completely fumbled.
Today, the state that I'm living in made it so that everybody over the age of 16 can get vaccinated, which is really great. That's even more hopeful.
The journal project was co-founded by Brown University anthropology professor Catherine Mason and Sarah Willen at the University of Connecticut. And Catherine Mason joins us now. Welcome, Catherine. It's good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
And listen, in the news business, we covered this story relentlessly. I remember some days it felt like every minute of our two-hour show was dedicated to COVID. I'm curious what makes these journal entries different from all the accounts in the news and across social media that we saw so much of at the time.
These are all anonymous, but I think what was really unique about this was it provided a really raw, real-time reflection that was not subject to kind of public performative posturing like what happens on social media. And we had a really wide variety of folks who were participating. And so it created sort of a snapshot weekly of what people were thinking and feeling.
You used the word raw, which is appropriate, I think, because the grief certainly was raw. More than a million Americans died, as I said, and many of those folks died alone in the hospital. Let's listen to some tape from one of your journal entries now.
We're not really making any massive changes in response to any of these tragedies. And I don't know, maybe they will come. I really hope that they will and that we spend a lot of time after this is over, whatever that means, really grieving everything that happened and all of the people that died and suffered.
How did you see the pain come to the surface through so many journal entries?
Oh, it was really intense, you know, and it was intense for our team reading these as we went along and were experiencing our own grief about things. There was, of course, grief for personal loss, grief for the magnitude of lives lost, but there was also grief for things lost and experiences lost, people losing the opportunity to have a, you know, normal college experience or their senior prom or losing the experience of introducing their newborn to family members who they couldn't see. Elderly folks felt like they were losing really precious time when they didn't know how much more time they had left and living in fear during that time. And so there's a profound sense of loss that permeated a lot of the entries.
Loss and loneliness because you could not touch people. It was taboo. I mean, I was struck by this entry which said, not only do I miss my friends, but I also miss strangers. I miss the random encounters I used to have with people on the street, in stores, at bars. I miss making a connection with someone and then going our own ways. What do you think about this loneliness and whether it's still 4 years later somehow still lingers in our society?
I think it does. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so important to remember. People were lonely, as you noted in that entry, for strangers. I mean, that was one of the things that was really interesting, this sort of loneliness for spaces full of people. So loneliness for crowded train, for a cafe, for just being able to walk out onto the street and see other people. That sense of like a bustling aliveness that was just gone for a while, as well as the inability to touch. Some folks early in the pandemic were talking about skin hunger, and we saw a lot of that.
We also can't ignore what else was happening at the time. There was a very contentious election going on, and of course, the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of police, which, as we know, sparked protests and a reckoning around the globe. I have a feeling this came through a lot in your journal entries. Can you talk about that and what you learned?
I mean, one of the things that was so interesting about doing this at this time was that, of course, it wasn't just the pandemic, right? It was the pandemic and the murder of George Floyd. It was the pandemic and the election. It was the pandemic and the wildfires, if you'll recall, in California in that first summer. So the pandemic and the January 6th insurrection. And people were talking about that in long kind of missives about all of these things together. So they'd start talking about the pandemic, and then they'd veer into social justice concerns, and then they'd start, you know, ranting about politics, and it was all mixed up together in one very chaotic experience for people.
we can see that these wounds still linger in our society, clearly the political wounds, the loneliness wounds we were talking about. And yet I think we've gotten to a point 4 years on where the pandemic is something that people don't really want to talk about anymore because it seems like life is back to normal. So I'm just curious, as time starts to pass even more, how do you think these journal entries will help people like you, historians even, understand what actually happened to us as a society because of this pandemic?
From the very beginning, this was always a historical project. And that was because we knew this was going to be a really significant event. And yet, as you noted, people wanted to forget it almost immediately. And I understand that, right? There's been this sort of collective amnesia of like, oh, that happened. Okay, now we're just back to normal. But we're not back to normal, right? A lot of things change, and there is this huge hole in people's lives. I mean, people are often, when I speak with them now, talk about the sort of pandemic vortex, right? Or this kind of fuzzy period that it's hard to even remember what was happening in 2020 and 2021. But a lot was happening, right? And it was incredibly impactful on, as you mentioned, the entire world. And it's really important, we think, to preserve those experiences so that people can go back and understand what was happening in people's homes, in people's families, you know, what struggles they were having, what joy they were finding, because it wasn't all doom and gloom. And to preserve this period and to preserve it in a way that allows for all different sorts of people to kind of leave their mark and make sure that their experiences are not forgotten.
There was joy. I think that's important. I remember watching my preschooler learn how to tie her shoes for the first time, and I'm not sure I would have been there with her otherwise. And I hope we can end on an uplifting note. Was there anything that you saw in these journal entries that made you, I don't know, that warmed your heart in any way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, people submitted music, they submitted art. There was a lot of discussion of the special time, as you note, that people had with their children that they were not expecting. And the journal entry I always think about when I think about joy is there is a young woman who worked at a homeless shelter. If you'll recall, there's also a national coin shortage. I don't know if you remember that, but there was a national coin shortage.
And she
was, yeah. And she was so upset about the fact that people couldn't get quarters and they couldn't get quarters for them to wash their clothes that she sent out a call on her kind of friend list. Does anybody have quarters? And just overnight on her porch, people left dozens and dozens of quarters. And she was really moved by people's desire to help each other, by people's feeling of collective hardship and feeling like they were all in this together. It didn't last long, unfortunately, in our country, but it did exist. And that was something I think that was special.
Yeah. Wow. Catherine Mason, an anthropology professor at Brown University, co-founder of the Pandemic Journaling Project. Thank you so much for spending time with us 4 years now after this pandemic broke out and shut down the country. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show. It comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian, Koyani Saxena, and Julia Corcoran. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Caleb Green and Michaela Varela. Our theme music is by Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into over 40 themes to choose from. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Visit schwab.com/thematic investing. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.